Hey, what you're about to listen to is the podcast version of what was a live radio segment on KPFA. Consequently, when you hear us give out a call-in number, you don't want to call it. If you're listening to this as a podcast, it is already too late, and nobody on the other end of that phone number is going to have any useful answers for you. All right, let's go to this week's Corona Calls. We're going to turn, as we do most weeks at this time, to the world of infectious diseases in a segment we call Corona Calls. Our guest is Dr. John Swartzberg, clinical professor emeritus of infectious diseases at UC Berkeley School of Public Health. Good morning, Dr. Swartzberg.
Good morning.
I wanted to start with the news this morning because it's been a couple weeks since we talked about new developments with H5N1 influenza, more commonly known as bird flu, since the last time you and I spoke. The FDA has reported that it found viral fragments of H5N1 in about 20% of milk samples it tested in what it believes is a representative sample of what is on American retail shelves, suggesting that the virus is much more widespread in America's dairy herds than previously reported. I believe there's only positive testing reported in 34 herds in the United States. I guess the first and foremost question is, are we at the point where it's worth worrying about bird flu yet?
Oh yeah, we're at the point of worrying about whether bird flu. The question is how much worry. And right now, I think the way I'm looking at it is that this is of concern. Influenza is always of concern. And the way this virus is spreading now in other mammals like cows, and cows, of course, are directly related to our food supply, this certainly raises a level of concern that we haven't had in a while with influenza. Now, that said, there's no reason for panic about this. We've had the one documented case of conjunctivitis in a farm worker, in a dairy worker, conjunctivitis meaning inflammation of the eye, and it was not serious, and there is no evidence of further spread from that person to other people. That said, there have been a lot of anecdotal reports of dairy herd workers with influenza-like illness, but they haven't been tested to see what they have. This is something that the USDA is worried about, the FDA is worried about, the CDC is worried about, people like me, I'm worried about it. So that's the best answer I can give you at this point. We should have concern.
We got a question on this front from Stephen in Connecticut in our inbox, who asks, how much different is the virus now that it's infecting cattle, as opposed to the virus that circulates amongst birds?
Not very. As a matter of fact, the virus that we've seen in cattle right now is the virus that we're seeing in birds. And we're now documenting that the virus comes from birds to cattle, but we've also seen evidence of cattle-to-cattle spread of this virus, and we've seen cattle back to bird spread, at least some evidence for that indirectly. So, this appears to be the same virus that's causing havoc in birds and cattle and some other mammals.
No significant mutations that enabled the spread from cow to cow?
No significant mutations. What we're really looking for, and we're getting back to your original question about how much should we worry, if we start documenting this virus in pigs, that is, that it's made the leap from cattle or from birds to pigs, I think we should raise our alarm bells even higher. The reason for that is that the way the virus gets into our respiratory cells, both upper and lower respiratory cells in pigs, is very similar to the way it gets into our cells. Those receptor sites, the sites where the virus latches onto our cells and goes into our body, are very similar between pigs and humans. And that would be of concern because if it's in pigs and spreading in pigs, that would really make it more likely that it could spread in humans.
it might face selection pressure because of those receptors that pigs share with people to evolve into a form that is more transmissible to people.
That's correct. Let me give you, though, a little piece of indirectly good news, and that is that the data we have on influenza, all types of influenza that's circulating in the United States, primarily in several types of influenza A and influenza B, we've seen it now, the numbers now go below the threshold that we consider a problem. And the testing that we're doing, while not looking directly for H5N1, what you were talking about earlier, the avian influenza, it does look for all influenza A viruses that are occurring now. And so we would have expected to see, if it was spreading in humans right now, we would have expected to see a larger number of cases than we're currently seeing, in a trajectory that was leveling off or going up, as opposed to the trajectory we're seeing that's going down.
Right. I guess we're at the phase of worry that is one step removed from person to person transmission, which is the virus is moving through very concentrated animal populations that people work with and are exposed to. Is there like much of a public health conversation on the advisability of, you know, our relatively recent system of putting vast numbers of animals in these confined animal feeding operations where you have thousands or tens of thousands living in extremely close quarters and capable of passing disease back and forth?
Well, I think infectious disease physicians, public health people in infectious disease have been concerned about this for a long, long time. This is a perfect storm for breeding resistant organisms. And we've seen this not just with viruses, but of course with bacteria and now perhaps fungi. So yes, this is not the best way to do things for us and for animals. That said, of course, it makes food awfully cheap here to raise flocks of birds and herds of cattle, for example, in the way we do it.
All right, let me open up the phone lines to questions from our listeners. 1-800-958-9008. If you've got questions about avian influenza or COVID-19, 1-800-958-9008 for your COVID calls. Dr. Swartzberg, there is one other new piece of research I wanted to run through before we go to listener questions. This comes out of a research group led by Akiko Iwasaki, who's a virologist at Yale. A lot of her research has been focusing on mucosal tissue, the tissue inside your nose and sinuses, and how to block it as an infection site for COVID. She's been working on nasal vaccines, which I think we've mentioned once or twice before, but just published research showing promising results from simply swabbing noses with antibacterial ointment, basically the generic version of Neosporin. They did this to mice, and they did it to hamsters, and they put them in a confined space with infected mice and hamsters, and it reduced the rate at which they passed the virus back and forth. And then they tried swabbing people. They did not deliberately expose them to COVID, but did document that in the cells in their nasal passages, there was a type of immune response triggered by the ointment. I guess my question is, is this just interesting, or is there a practical application for this insight?
I would put it in the just interesting category. She and her group do outstanding science. So whenever I see something published by her, I always pay particular attention. This is very interesting in terms of, not that the Neosporin, for example, which is an antibacterial ointment, would have an effect on the virus, but does it change anything in the way our host cells might respond if we got infected with the virus? And that's the question. And the animal studies suggested possibly, the human studies were really much too limited to make too much out of, but it's certainly a road that needs exploring. I don't think we're nearly at the point where one would recommend using Neosporin in your nose to prevent viral infections in general, respiratory viral infections in general, and certainly COVID specifically.
So the finding when they looked at what happened to cells after they were swabbed was that this stimulated some kind of innate immune response, interferon production, not a specific response to COVID.
Exactly. So this necessitates a brief journey into immunology. What the vaccines do is they give us lots of antibodies to the virus. They educate our cells, immune cells, to attack the virus. So it works. The vaccines work once the virus has gotten into us. Some vaccines also work by stimulating antibodies in, for example, the nose and the throat that would prevent the virus from even infecting our cells. That's generally speaking how the vaccines work. But we also have another arm to our immune system besides the antibodies in the cells. We have an arm called the innate immune system. And that is that this is something that doesn't require a vaccine, doesn't require any education of our body. We're born with this ability where if a pathogen, bacteria, virus, fungus, et cetera, attacks our cells, that we have an innate response. And a key element of that innate response is a chemical called interferon, which we've known about back into the very early 70s. This interferon essentially warns our other cells that there's something here that we should fight off and can be very active in doing that. So this is the idea that the Neosporin is stimulating interferon production, and therefore if we do inhale, let's say SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID, our innate immune response would be all revved up and be able to deal with that. You know, Brian, I'm going to just extend this a little bit, if you'll bear with me. One of the things that we've observed consistently in the pandemic is that the older you are, particularly being over 65, the less likely you're going to handle the viral infection well. And we've been really trying to understand why that is. And there's evidence that we call it immune senescence, meaning our immune system is getting old too. But what we've learned recently is that with age, that innate immune response doesn't work as well. And specifically, interferon production doesn't work as well. So this may be part of the explanation. I don't know how big of a part, but it could be a large part of the explanation why older people don't handle SARS-CoV-2 as well as younger people.
Is that less targeted innate immune response also potentially a source of problems? My understanding is that the advice for like first aid wound care has moved away from suggesting antibiotic ointments like Neosporin for clean cuts and wounds because of the risk of triggering an allergic response and sensitization.
Right. An allergic response is a big concern. Another concern is resistant organisms, resistant bacteria to the antibiotics in Neosporin. So there's really no evidence for the need of Neosporin on a clean wound. I certainly don't want to encourage people to go out and be swabbing not only their noses, but any wound they have, no matter how minor, with these antibacterial ointments.
I guess if we extend that out further, does that say anything about whether this would, after further study, be a practical public health measure to swab noses in times of high transmission?
Too early to tell, I think, is the answer. We're really not nearly at the stage where we could make a recommendation like that.
Fair enough. Dr. Swartzberg, since we've got low activity on our phone lines this morning, I'd like to move on to a conversation I've wanted to have for a while. You know, we've periodically gotten forwarded to our email studies people have come across or more likely had forwarded to them that just appeared to be very low quality. like in journals nobody's heard of, making claims that the argument didn't seem to support. And up till this point, I've always thought, well, you probably haven't read them. And also, people listen to the radio in a state of distraction while they're commuting or doing the dishes or gardening. I don't want to, in the course of repeating something that is bad information for the purpose of challenging it, accidentally spread the bad information. But I think we've kind of moved to the point in the pandemic where we can kind of talk about how to recognize bad work in the wild. And I was hoping to do that with something that recently arrived in our inbox. This came from Sam in Oakland, who asked what you thought of a paper published in a journal I had never heard of previously called Curious, entitled Increased Age-Adjusted Cancer Mortality After the Third mRNA Lipid Nanoparticle Vaccine Dose During the COVID-19 Pandemic in Japan. And if I could give a layperson's summary, the article is making a statistics-based claim that cancer rates were in decline in Japan through 2020 and then ticked up. I don't have enough math under my belt to assess the quality of their statistical analysis there, but that seems to be their original contribution. Then they kind of make a footnote-based claim that there's an argument that COVID vaccines could cause cancer. In other words, they're outsourcing the argument to other people. I followed some of the footnotes. It looked like very low-quality papers. And then they're saying, on the basis of those two things, they're strongly implying that widespread vaccination in Japan could have caused a small increase in cancer rates. I should probably stop there and see if I'm summarizing the claims in the paper well.
Sure. And thank you for sending me that paper, because I would not have seen it otherwise. I think they were looking at making the claim that cancer deaths had increased.
Yes, cancer deaths.
And they were making the claim that this was due to the vaccine, statistically associated with the vaccine, although they were making the claim that it very well, very likely was due to the vaccine. Yeah.
So I guess what I wanted to go through with you is, if you are someone who is forwarded this by a friend or comes across it in a social media feed, aside from just having faith in the fact that vaccines that have been through, you know, multiple clinical trials spanning tens of thousands of people and been scrutinized by public agencies before they were allowed to enter public circulation probably don't have these types of negative effects. How would you tell whether a paper like this raises a credible cause for concern?
Sure. And I encounter this often as well. That is, people sending me papers and asking me to take a look at them, which I'm, of course, happy to do. So in looking at this paper, well, let me just be more general. Here's what I do when I see a paper, regardless of where it's been published. The first thing I look at is, where has it been published? Is this a reputable journal? As you mentioned, for example, is Sirius. I had never heard of this journal. And so it prompted me to take a look on the internet and find out something about this journal. And it falls under the category of what we call a predatory journal. That is, these are journals that people who have researchers who want to publish their data will essentially pay to play. And so those kind of papers, you don't want to be, you just want to put them away at that point, because obviously there's going to be a tremendous bias in whatever the researchers are saying. So first thing to do is look at where it's published. And of course, if it's published in a very good journal in medicine, for example, New England Journal of Medicine, Annals of Internal Medicine, or Journal of the American Medical Association, these are top-notch journals, the Journal of Science, the Journal of Nature. So anything published in those, I'm going to pay careful attention to, because I know that these articles have been very, very well vetted. The second thing I look at is, who are the authors? Now, this is my field, of course, and so I'm going to know a lot of people in this field. And the lay public isn't going to know people in this field. But I'm very interested in who the authors are, what is their background, what is their expertise in this area. And then I want to jump into the study itself. And here are five things that I pay very careful attention to. The first thing I want to get is in the abstract and in the introduction is what is the story that they're trying to tell? The next section in a journal article is going to be called methods, and this is how they did their study. This is where the devil is in the details. And this is where, if you read carefully, you can often find things that are going to concern you or find things that are going to reassure you about the data. The third area is the results they found from those methods. And also, this is where you want to look very carefully. Do the results follow what the methods suggested they should? Do the results follow what's in the methods? Oftentimes, there's a disconnect there, which would raise a red flag. The fourth thing I look at is the discussion. What do they say in their discussion about this? Do they talk about the limitations of the study? Do they talk about the strengths of the study? Do they take a careful look at the body of literature that has been done before them to see how their results fit with the body of literature? Do they suggest something new, or do they reaffirm what we've seen before? And then finally, I look at the references. Do the references, are they accurate in terms of the claims that the authors are making when they looked at the literature? So there's five things: the introduction, the methods, the results, and the discussions and the references. So there's a lot to look at. It takes work. I often look at journal reading or article reading is very much like a piece of art, a painting, for example, or a musical piece. And the painting is not going to be very good if every piece of that painting is not very good. Same thing with the music. And then there has to be, beyond that, a coherence to the entire article that paints a beautiful picture or creates a beautiful song. And so you look for the coherence of all the elements together. So it's a lot of work when you do this. And so sometimes when people have sent me articles, I sort of internally groan and think, oh gosh, I'm gonna have to put some work into this, because you can't just glance at it and make a decision. All of that said, and then I'll stop, Ryan, all of that said is that when I looked at this article from Curious, none of it fit together. The results didn't follow the methods. The methods were questionable. There was a much better explanation for everything. And in their discussion, they just threw in, called the spaghetti argument, where they threw spaghetti against the wall and were hoping that something would stick there.
I find it reassuring those are your criteria, because a couple of them are things I use to assess not just journal articles, but like the credibility of news reporting. Any good reporting that purports to explain something should summarize and engage with other possible explanations of the same phenomenon. The same goes for academic articles. So here, if you're saying there's a slight increase in a certain number of cancers in a population, you should probably engage more than one potential explanation other than it's possibly linked to widespread vaccination. One obvious one, and they're looking at cancer mortality, as you pointed out, that occurred to me was in 2020, because of lockdowns, many fewer people are getting cancer screenings. Cancers that are caught later are treated later and more likely to be fatal in subsequent years. That wasn't even outlined as a possibility in the text of the paper.
Right. We did see an increase in cancer mortality all over the world during the COVID pandemic. And we saw it for the reason, a big reason was what you mentioned, people stopped going to get screening. They didn't get their colonoscopies, for example, or they didn't get other screening tests that would have been helpful. People were reluctant to go see physicians during that period of time. There was a lot of telemedicine where screening couldn't really take place. So there are lots of explanations for that that are much more tenable than what these authors proposed.
All right. Other interesting things happen when you follow the footnotes or references they use in lieu of making an argument themselves, but we don't have time to get into that today. Hopefully that's helpful for those of you who periodically get these in your own inboxes. Dr. Swartzberg, thank you so much for spending another Monday morning with us.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
All right, that does it for this week's edition of Corona Calls. If you want to send in a question for next week's, you can email coronacalls@kpfa.org. Or tune in live to Call In Live. Usually we air Monday mornings right after 7:30 news headlines on KPFA 94.1 FM in the Bay Area or kpfa.org anywhere in the world. We put a little bit of extra work into repackaging this live segment as a podcast because it feels like the information is useful to a lot of people. We ought to make it accessible through as many channels as possible. You can help us get the word out by rating and reviewing it in whatever app you're using to listen. And if you want to pitch in some cash, we wouldn't say no. We always take donations at kpfa.org. I appreciate it if you mentioned Corona Calls when you make your pledge. My name is Brian Edwards-Tiegert. I hope you have a great week. Stay well. We'll talk to you next time.